Initiate Cowrat Podcast.
Yeah. We'll just have to leave that part out.
So 12 days ago, it was D-Day. Not like a big national holiday, but one thing I like to try to do, I haven't done it very often, is play Memoir 44 on D-Day and do a beach landing scenario. Didn't work out this time, but I want to read this from the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. This was a letter given to the troops from Dwight D. Eisenhower coming up to D-Day. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of the liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940 and 41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Just a comment on World War II in general, that it seems to have been the epicenter for a lot of technological advancements, a lot of government funding thrown at a lot of things in a hurry. Things changed in a hurry after World War II. One of my hobbies is photography, and one of the things I like to photograph is military aircraft, especially military aircraft. And it's always cool if you can catch a warbird like a Corsair or a Mustang or B-17 or P-38. Jets are a blast, too. I don't make it to nearly as many air shows as I'd like to, but we made it to one last year and got to see the F-16. And they often do what they call a heritage flight, which is different generations of aircraft flying together. So what I'd really like to see is the A-10, F-15, F-35, P-51 all flying together. I saw that they did one of bombers. They did one of the B-52, B-17, and a B-25, I think. That would have been very cool to catch that. But as I've mentioned before, photographing propeller planes, you have to, the industry speak is drag the shutter a bit, which is to slow the shutter speed down enough so that you get a little bit of blur from the rotation of the propeller, because that gives you a sense of motion so you can actually tell, yes, the thing's actually flying, not just a static display somewhere.
Right, exactly.
Amateurs run shutter speeds where there's no prop blur whatsoever.
Right.
Anyway, so that's one of the things you learn and research when you're photographing different things you've never photographed before. But photographing aircraft is always a blast. Doing the military demo teams, the Blue Angels, the T-Birds, because they one of them headlines a lot of the air shows around the country every year. That's a big deal, the air show circuit. But it's fun to go on practice day, which is usually the Thursday before the weekend, because then you can position yourself someplace else off the grounds or real near the airport so you can see different parts of their flight patterns. See, catch not just the organized maneuvers together, but them making turns to line up for the next pass and flying over trees and things like that that you can't see from the air show grounds. Anyway, the last shows that we've had in town, I always make a point to do that. Go out on practice day and shoot them then.
So when you go on practice day, can anyone just show up, or how does that?
So you don't actually go to the airport. You go near the airport.
I see. And then they might fly near you at some point, or?
Right. There's always an approach path that's directly in line with the runway, because that's where they're going to flow over. That's center point is over the runway. and there's a, they call center point. That's the position where the announcer's at, technically.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the center of whatever maneuver it is supposed to happen.
I see.
So like when the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels do the opposing solos, they're supposed to appear to have crossed paths right at center point.
Got it.
If you're familiar with the area, you can go line yourself up somewhere just off, because once they pass out of view, they're going to change direction and fly wherever. They got to go kill 30 seconds until they come back around again, especially like 5 and 6, the solos. They have to kill a lot of time lining up and staying out of the way for the Diamond to do their maneuver.
Hmm.
So it's always fun to catch them because they'll do real dramatic turns to get lined up to go where they need to go. They'll, I saw them do this a couple times where they'd like psh, 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 with the smoke, so you'd see these dashes in the sky.
Oh, I see.
And I don't know if that's a communication between them or exactly what that is. I haven't looked that up, but so it's fun to watch. So you get, the other thing you get on practice day is they both fly a two-seater, a trainer version of the aircraft, and they're always doing PR rides. So sometimes it's somebody from the paper. The whole point of the demo teams is to promote the armed services. You read all kinds of stories about different dignitaries and movie stars and stuff getting a ride, and of course Tom Cruise before they filmed Top Gun, that whole thing. But they'll, a lot of time they really emphasize on taking people who are looking at getting into the military or people who are influencers that are like college age, because the whole point of the two demo teams is to promote the armed services. And you'll get to see the two-seater version fly on practice day, and you won't see it fly on the regular showtime unless they have maintenance issues and they have to use it as the sixth aircraft, which has happened before. So knowing this, the last time the Blues were here, I positioned myself out on the trail south of the lake there, which is right in line. So I was able to get a good long shot at it as it came in, since they're not flying these crazy maneuvers. They're flying more generally like another passenger aircraft would. I knew they'd line up over that area. But I got lucky and caught a B-25 that was flying for that show, practicing that day as well. So that's always cool.
Oh, you're talking about the puffs of smoke. There was something I was listening to talking about skywriting. You know, airplanes that leave the smoke trail and they'll write words in the sky. First of all, it's a very specific skill set to some pilots. But they were talking about the thing I thought was kind of cool was, this, obviously with modern technology, everything can be easier and you don't have to know what you're doing. But interesting concept that they can now get like multiple planes flying side by side, and each, it'll be like a printer.
Oh, yeah.
Each one will leave one puff of smoke in a certain spot and they'll all together look like a letter. And then they can even have, like, computers that run it all and sync up. And so the pilot just has to fly in a straight line, and the computers will shoot the puffs of smoke at the correct time to print the words in the air.
Nice.
I would still be more impressed by the old-fashioned one pilot doing loop-de-loops and spelling letters himself.
Yeah. So in Granite Falls, Minnesota, we have Fagan Fighters World War II Museum, and they have a number of functioning warbirds. Tricky part with them is they don't always announce very far in advance when they're flying. And so to get there from here, you can't just do it last minute to try and photograph them, which would be really cool. But we've both been to the museum, and I took a bunch of pictures of them parked, you know, in the hangars.
Right, yeah.
They have a lot of well-done displays there, and they continue to add aircraft as well. And they have an air show every so many years, so we'll have to try and catch it the next time they do a show. Because they'll have other people flying as well. In fact, when we were there, they had somebody who also owned a warbird who was just coming to check out their stuff.
Oh, okay.
Who had flown, I think, at one of their shows before. But the thing about the warbirds is they're slowly but surely trickling down to, like, the B-17. I think there's only 9 airworthy B-17s left in the world.
Wow.
8 of them are in the U.S., one's in the U.K. But, you know, they make parts for these things anymore.
You're right, I suppose. I mean, somebody could make one, right? It's not coming out of a factory, but...
There's a lot of machining, which is my theory on why the Fagan family got into it. I mean, that's machining is what they do, so
it makes sense.
They can fab the stuff that they have no choice but to fab.
Right. One of the displays they have at the Fagan Fighters Museum is statues of guys coming off one of the boats onto
one of the beaches.
Yeah, one of the beaches on D-Day. It's supposed to be a D-Day display. When you're looking at it from the front, there's all these guys running out toward you with their guns, and they have actual sand that the statues are in, and they got some tank trap things set up. if when you walk around to the side of it, it's not like the whole boat. It's just kind of attached to another part of the building. There's a wall there, and and there was a door. So me and my mom and brother and a couple of my kids went. So we're looking at the front of this, and I went around the side, and I'm like, oh, there's a door there. And it says men's room on it or something. So I open it. It's just a bathroom for people to use who are visiting the museum for just the public. So I said, Dad, look at this. You can see inside the boat. And he comes wheeling around on his scooter that he had at the time. And I had the door partly open, and I opened the door. I'm like, they have a whole modern bathroom in here. He's like rolling his eyes. Uh-huh. Yeah, very funny.
Right, exactly. They have that outdoor display, too, of a... That's supposed to be on the beach also, where they have the, I guess you could call them traps, but they're just gigantic steel girder X's that so nothing can drive over them or drive through. Mm-hmm. And then the concrete bunker, I can't remember if there's a big gun in there, but that's off outside, away from the hangars.
Yeah, I remember seeing they had a concrete bunker with a gun. It's not a real gun, it just looks like one.
Yeah.
And but they'll shoot something, it'll blow something up. When I was there, they said that they will raise the gun and make it look like it's shooting at planes flying overhead or whatever.
Yeah.
So talking about shooting at planes, one podcast I was listening to, they were talking about survivorship bias, if you've ever heard of that concept or...
No.
So just for example, I mean, what I'm about to say is like the most famous example, but like when somebody wants to do a study and get statistics on something, they'll pick the most obvious examples. Say you want to study a certain sickness. And so you go find people who've had that sickness and you do all kinds of studies on them. And you go, okay, here's all the facts and all the statistics. But what you forgot is you didn't study any of the people who died from the disease. So you look,
right,
but it didn't occur
can.
To you. So you only study the people who survived because that's all you have.
Right.
So you're missing huge portions of information. But again, it's a bias that you accidentally fall into when gathering information. And so this happened during World War II. Planes would come back from battle, and somebody had the idea, like, hey, we should study where are these things getting hit.
Right.
So we can design them better to take damage or whatever. And so they saw these patterns of where they studied all these planes and looked at the bullet holes. And then, okay, and they made these diagrams, like, here's where the planes most often get hit. Let's bulk them up and add more armor to these areas.
Right.
So they did all this and whatever, and it didn't seem to make any effect.
Because those are the ones that made it back.
Exactly.
Hitting it there didn't take them down.
Somebody finally realized, like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
These guys don't need more armor. They survived.
Right.
The ones that died, where did they get hit? That's the more important question.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they eventually, what they did with it. I don't remember all the details. I just thought it was an interesting. Of course, you study the planes you have.
Right.
And the ones that never came back, you can't study. So another interesting fact that I don't know if it was on the same episode, but they were talking about eventually, they didn't do it at first, but they eventually realized if we make the seats adjustable and other things adjustable in the cockpit of an airplane, people can fly them more easily.
Yeah, on that note, so speaking of adjustability, and I don't remember the numbers, but there is a specified range of how tall a pilot can or has to be.
Oh, really?
There's a limit.
Huh.
When I found quite entertaining, obviously these two ladies are flying military jets, so, you know, I'm nobody. I'm just simply just saying it was amusing to see the photo of last summer. Both the Blues and the Thunderbirds have a female pilot, one each.
Oh, okay.
And they were standing next to each other in this photo, and there's like a foot difference between the two of them almost.
Oh,
I mean, they like are on the extreme ends of tallest and shortest of who can be in there. I just found that entertaining. But
Right.
And I got to put a plug in here again for my favorite military-oriented podcast, which is the Fighter Pilot Podcast by Vincent Jello Aiello, because does a very good job. Mm-hmm. Interview some very interesting people, every one of them.
So my dad was 10-ish years old during World War II. So obviously he didn't like fight in World War II or whatever. He has, you know, some memories of it, but...
All four of my folks, my biological parents and my adopted parents, were involved in World War II in some way. My biological parents were both in the Marine Corps.
Hmm.
My adopted parents both worked for McDonnell Douglas building the B-17 in Long Beach, California.
Oh, wow.
That's actually how they met. Dad worked in the bomb bay door section, and mom worked in the tail section, if I remember correctly.
Hmm.
turns out there was a number of facilities building a lot of these aircraft throughout the country at the time. I imagine for volume and maybe for security purposes as far as spreading out the manufacturing. So if they were to make it over our country, make it more difficult for them to take out our manufacturing because it's not all one location. And a lot of it was actually in the center of the country to keep it as far away from the coast as possible. Like there's a lot of manufacturing in Wichita.
It reminds me and the boys watched a series of like the weapons of World War II. I think it was specifically like the Nazi weapons. But the Germans had this idea to build this like massive manufacturing facility for some big weapon. I forget what it was, but in order to protect it, you know, they had it like partly underground and they had this like massive concrete shield on top of it that was like dome shaped. So bombs would kind of bounce off of it rather than want to go right through and whatever. And so, of course, the Allies, when they discovered it, they went bombed it and they hardly did any damage because they protected it so well. And they were like, well, how can we get this thing? And then somebody had the idea, like, we can just destroy all of the roads in and out of it and make it useless.
Make it an island, yeah.
Right, exactly. Plus, I mean, the main manufacturing was under this shield, but there were still supplies and little places around it that, like I said, roads and maybe other, like, cities and whatever.
The input and the output.
Right, exactly. So the Germans are like, okay, nothing is invincible.
No. So we actually went to a movie not too long ago called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which was based on true events of the British doing this mission, and it's called Ungentlemanly Warfare because they didn't follow all the established Geneva Convention rules and whatever else at the time to do this, but their mission was they went and destroyed. I mean, the U-boats were cleaning our clocks, so they said, you know, all we got to do is figure out how they're getting supplied and go take that out. So that's what they did. A highly dramatized and fictionalized version of that in the movie, but the essence of the story is just go to the supply point, take it out, and they're done.
Right.
Because it was the British head honcho of the military at that time.
Not Winchester.
Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill. Winchester.
Charles Emerson Winchester.
Yeah, exactly. My brother and I are watching that show right now, MASH.
Oh, man.
Because I remember it as a kid, and every once in a while I'll be watching. I remember that scene. I remember that line. So
the thing we didn't pick up on as children was all the liberal slants from Mr. Alan Alda. And,
yes, of course. Yeah, now I'm seeing those.
The radar. Yeah, he was so classic because he was always just getting the job done, had all these connections and everything, but it was so unassuming. Like,
right.
Oh, man. But you want to talk to the guy in charge or the guy who knows what's going on?
Yeah, right. But one thing I think is cool, I don't know, it gives me World War II vibes because of the uniforms.
Right, you know,
and the helmets and whatever. One thing that I thought was really cool was it was a scene in the mess tent. And then all of a sudden, like front and center, there's this metal, probably stainless steel, I guess, like drink pitcher.
Yeah.
And I saw that. I'm like, and I paused and I'm like, that's where they got them. They're probably army surplus. We have gone every year to a family reunion. It's always in a state park in Indiana. And the state parks have all these cabins you can stay in and then a big mess hall. And in the mess hall, they have all the plates and cups and knives and forks and everything you need. And all the drink pitchers are the stainless steel and they're all beat up. And I'm thinking, like, they must have got them. They must have been army surplus. Well, it's a state park, so.
Yeah. Well, our lunch trays in grade school were all stainless steel, all punched. They look like the fiber, not fiberglass, but the fiber ones you'll see. But they're all punched on the back. I think it was on the back side. It said USN.
Oh, really?
On the back of all of them.
So, of course, I took a picture, the TV screen with that thing, and I posted it on our Facebook family group. Like, yeah. Hey, everybody, guess what I just figured out?
Right.
Probably half the people older than me already knew, but.
Now, wasn't those chintzy imitation aluminum ones, was it? Like the old aluminum cups, you know, they're available in those like red, blue, green, gold.
Oh.
But they were aluminum. It's like, that's not scary.
Yeah, right.
Alzheimer's, anybody?
Yeah. Suddenly brought back memories.
That would make sense. So what's your favorite war movie?
Probably Saving Private Ryan, I guess.
Pretty intense.
Yeah. I like the D-Day scene.
War by nature is horrifically violent, but the one thing you can tip your hat to the movie makers for on that one is the fact that many World War II vets saw it Mm-hmm. A lot of them left the theater during that scene because they're like, I mean, it's like they could almost smell the diesel fuel and they are, it's like they were there. It's like it was extremely well replicated.
Right, yeah. I guess the other thing is like, I'm not really a movie guy. Some people have watched 1,000 movies. I just haven't watched that many.
Yeah.
I have this, like, this is part of me, like, I want to watch all the World War II movies, but.
Yeah. That's an investment, yes.
Right, yeah, time. One that I really like that my son was disappointed in when we watched it, because it was a World War II movie, but there's no fighting. I don't think they even shoot a gun. Is Valkyrie, I really liked, which is the plan to assassinate Hitler by some German officers, which is, of course, it's probably Hollywoodized, but I really liked it. I also listened to a podcast that did an episode on the Valkyrie project, or the, I forget, they had a word for it, is project, not project.
Operation?
Operation Valkyrie, I think that sounds right. And from what they said, from a lot of the details I got, like, the movie was, it followed a lot of the main points pretty accurately.
Yeah, 2008 film by Bryan Singer, Valkyrie.
The one thing I just really didn't like was they didn't do German accents because they were playing Germans. And it just threw me off. I don't know, maybe nobody else cares, but here's how I see it. So if you got, if it's, let's say it's all Americans and they're playing Germans, okay, I guess you don't have to use German accents. So the main character just spoke regular English. Some of the characters were British, and so they, or the actors were British, even though they were playing Germans. So they just spoke with British accents. I'm like, it just messed everything up. You know what I'm saying? At least be consistent with what kind of accent you're using to portray Germans. I don't know. I'm so used to just hearing German accents from, you know, German soldiers in World War II movies, but they didn't attempt any accents. At the beginning of the movie, he was writing a letter, and you just hear like a voiceover, like, saying what he's writing, and it's in German, so if you don't speak German, you can't understand it. And then they slowly fade to him saying it in English, so you get the I think that's to set it up, like, these guys are talking German, they're speaking German, so
just pretend
they're speaking German for the rest of the movie. But the fact that they had British accents and American accents, it's like the British were a big part of World War II.
Weird. So,
but other than that, it was a good movie. The scene where they, spoiler, I guess, if you haven't seen the movie and you want to, skip.
Yeah, plug your ears.
And this is a real spoiler. This isn't like, spoiler alert, they die in the end, like where you don't have time to pause it. Like,
yeah.
Or they say, whoops, spoiler alert, by the way, from what I just said. Like, that's not an alert. That's after the fact. Too late. So have you seen the movie? Do you know the story?
Vaguely know the story. I've seen the trailer. That's it.
Yeah. Okay. So their attempt to kill Hitler is, they have a bomb in a briefcase, and this guy gets himself into a meeting with Hitler and the top head honchos. You know, he's a high-up ranking officer of some kind in the German army, but he's on the side of the Allies at this point. Like, we have to kill this guy. He's going to destroy Germany, and,
yeah,
you know, we need to kill him and surrender and get be done with this.
Wow.
And so he and a bunch of other Germans are, you know, plotting together. And so they take the bomb in there, and he... he has a war injury, and I think he may have a hearing issue, so he specifically requested to be near Hitler for the meeting so he could hear better. Of course, he had this bomb in this briefcase. That was his real plan. And so he sets the bomb right next to Hitler. Then he's like, says, oh, I got to go to the bathroom or something, and leaves and gets in a getaway car and leaves. That's the whole plan. And the meeting was supposed to be in some kind of concrete bunker. And they said, if a bomb goes off in this place, everyone's dead. There's no question. Everyone in the room is going to die. So they were also going to take out a lot of the top bigwigs, yep, along with him. Another part of the plot and the plan wasn't just, okay, kill Hitler. Like, we need to know what we're going to do next. And yeah, so they change some of the ways the army works and a little bit of the authority structure. He gives himself a little more power and gives himself a little more permission to do certain things with the military. So they have a plan of like, okay, immediately when the news comes out that Hitler dies, we got to arrest that guy. We got to arrest that guy. We got to get these guys in custody so they can't
continue.
Get them out of the way so we can take power and whatever. But the problem is, right, the last minute, they said, it's too hot. This meeting is going to take place in a cabin a little ways away from the bunker. And now, because it's in a cabin with windows, the pressure or whatever of the, yeah, bomb, nobody died. Hitler got a leg injury and that was it.
Oh.
Yeah, it was just like, once you find out that, like, all of a sudden, like, the meeting's been changed, they're like, no, everybody's hopes just dropped. And they're like, well, we're going to try anyway, but it didn't work. So
it sounds like a World War II era Mission Impossible mission.
Yeah, right.
Tom Cruise is in it. They're going on an impossible mission,
right.
Only they fail.
Right, right. Yeah. They do stick to the true story. They don't make him win in the end for the plot reasons. Mm-hmm. That is one thing with movies. Of course, everybody wants a happy ending. Everybody wants the good guy to win and the bad guy to lose.
Yeah.
And when they do, in a fictional movie, when they make the bad guy win, you're like, that was terrible. Why did they write it that way? This was a dumb movie. They shouldn't have done that. But then if you're watching a movie based on history where it doesn't travel, they go, well, that's okay because it was actually history.
Yeah.
It was still an enjoyable movie.
Right.
I heard somebody commenting on the Titanic movie from, what, the 90s?
Yeah, it was like 90,
late 90s.
Seven, I think.
Some radio show or something. It's like, yeah, terrible movie. Thumbs down. Everybody dies in the end.
Spoiler alert.
Right.
Yeah, 1997.
Just recently, I watched with my two younger boys The Pentagon Wars.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And, of course, you got to either listen to it or bleep, you know, bleep, if you have bleep, something bleep. That can bleep out the massive amounts of foul language. But other than that, there's no...
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Like innuendos or scenes you would need to skip because they're inappropriate. That is one thing I did like about the movie. That was
yeah.
And it was almost a comedy movie in a way.
Oh, man.
Even though it was based on a true story.
It'd be hilarious if it wasn't so pathetic.
Yeah, right. And obviously that's not World War II.
No, your government at work.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's shocking how many. I mean, I think it was the P-51s. They were still cranking them out after the war was over, and they junked them all.
Oh, no.
It's just insane.
P-51 is...
the Mustang. That was the Air Force's fastest prop plane.
I see.
Before jets, and the Corsair was the Navy's fastest prop plane before jets. Mm. There was a show I watched growing up called Baba Black Sheep, which was... Mm. Very loosely based on the military escapades of Gregory Pappy Boyington, who was leading a squadron of Corsairs in the Solomon Islands, I believe it was. So it was 1976, and Robert Conrad plays Boyington. But so at that time, the Corsairs are a lot younger than they are now. I mean, there's still some flying, and they're very, very cool. But that was they had World War II actual aircraft footage, you know, black and white. Mm-hmm. Footage off the aircraft that you'd see the same clips over and over again, you know, them shooting tracers and hitting zeros and all that stuff. But I remember growing up on that, and that's probably the source of my fondness for the Corsair, but it's just such a cool-looking aircraft. But she was a beast. Things you had to watch out for. Like if you over-throttle a thing, she'd just flip over because the engine had so much torque. If they throttled up too quickly, literally the plane would flip as they're taking off.
I see.
And the P-51 had so much power. It was one of my classmates at vocational school was telling me, I don't know if it was one of his uncles. Somebody in the family flew one, and they didn't tell the trainees early enough at first how much power the thing had. And a lot of the guys, they'd go to take off, and they'd throttle way up, and they'd pull up, and the thing would actually go up, and then they would nosedive because it would stall right away because it had the power to get off the ground quickly, but you still got to watch your angle.
Right, yeah.
So it was incredibly powerful as well.
Another interesting World War II thing that I came across, I was listening to a documentary. Basically, they hired a bunch of, I don't know, psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever, to like psychoanalyze Hitler. Obviously, they couldn't sit down and interview him. These were the Allies or the Americans, whoever did it. But they got a hold of as much as they could of information on him, his childhood and whatever else. Not that I put a lot of stock into
right.
You know, this kind of thing. But they were trying to like come at it from a psychological, like predict what he was going to do or essentially that. Like, but they got it right, at least in one area of it. The psychologists predicted that he would never surrender and he would destroy Germany if he had to. He would fight until...
He was not reasonable. He would.
Right.
It was his plan or not at all. So we're going to execute my plan until it kills everybody else or kills me.
Right. Yeah. If the whole country's destroyed, I don't care. I'm not going to quit. Yeah. I'm not going to give up.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a psychological term for that kind of personality.
Yeah. Basically, like megalomaniac, sort of like everything was about him and
right.
Just the worst kind of leader.
Right.
You know, in one sense, he was a good leader in that he got people to follow him.
Right.
You know, obviously using manipulation and lies but, you know, put himself before everyone else. Everything, the whole country was for his ego, you know. And then at the very end, when he finally did, quote unquote, give up, he didn't say, let's try to save what we can. He just killed himself.
Yeah.
Like, again, it was all about him.
Right.
So, and just let everyone else, whatever happens to them, I don't care.
Yep. I have some questionable theories on all of that, but I fully stand behind the fact that it seemed to be the catalyst for a whole ton of technological advances because of government funding in the name of peace. That if you look at technology's pretty much exploded from there because of all the experimentation they threw money at over in the name of weapons, you know, all the aircraft. I see these things show up in my Facebook feed because I click on a lot of military aircraft videos. And there's a lot of experimental aircraft. Two prototypes were built at a cost of whatever. None of them ever actually flew, or none of them were produced. They found out X, Y, Z. Which, I get that, you know, if there's specific angles you're trying to experiment on, because you don't have the computing power we do now, no other way to do it except to build them and see what happens.
Right, but yeah.
A lot of money.
That reminds me, not World War II related, but talking about building models of things and calculating things before computers. Apparently a guy, can't remember the decade or the time frame, but long before computers, the government or whatever branch was of the government was trying to predict flooding. I think it was the Mississippi River. And so this guy had ideas like, let's build a scale model of the entire Mississippi River basin, like all the hills, all of the, you know, where the cities are and whatever, and then fill it with water. Do different things to add too much water, see what happens. And apparently, like, they did such a good job that it worked. They could predict flooding and different things. Apparently, this thing still exists. Now it's kind of a museum.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a massive model.
Yeah, I saw a video on that.
Hydraulic model of the Mississippi River Basin covering an area of 2,000 acres. Yeah, built from 1943 to 1966.
Mm-hmm. Clinton, Mississippi.
Wow. It was in operation from 1949 to 1973. That's a lot later than I was imagining. Oh, I see. This is a different one. The better known San Francisco Bay model
covers
1.5 acres.
That's the one I saw.
And the Chesapeake Bay model covers 8 acres. So 200 is a lot in comparison. So, you know, for the church talent show a couple years ago, me and my boys and a friend did the World War II skit. It's just total comedy.
Yep.
But I feel like for a 45-year-old, I had way too much fun putting the costumes together.
Yeah.
You know, I just went to thrift stores, bought green clothes that you could pass as World War II from a distance to somebody watching who doesn't really know what they're looking at.
Yep.
And I ordered the helmets from Amazon. They're just plastic helmets, you know, that looked good to me. They didn't look like cheap toys, I guess, at least in my opinion. And one of the helmets I already had, my brother gave it to me. He bought it at the Fleet Farm Army Surplus aisle, which isn't there anymore, but they used to have one. And it wasn't an American. It was an actual World War II helmet, but it was from, I don't know, Austria or something. But so after I did this, you know, obviously I saved everything and they're just in a box in the basement at the moment. But
waiting for the next time, part two.
Yeah, right. I've thought it would be cool to like collect World War II stuff, uniform and whatever else I can. But, you know, I'm not a big spender on anything. So if it costs too much, I'm just not going to do it, you know. And the other thing, I always have to, like, what would I do with it?
Right.
If I'm just going to put it in a box. Then yeah,
exactly.
There's no point. Some people do that. It's fine.
Jim would say he put it in a box or put it in a closet because it's stuff. Stuff makes you happy.
Right. Yeah. I feel like if I was going to do that, though, I want to display it at least, make a cool looking little display. But then where would that be? I don't know. I'm not sure what gave me the idea. Suddenly I realized, I'm like, there are World War II reenactments. And guys who are into this, they get their uniforms pieced together. I don't know. I'm sure there's some standard or criteria, like you have to have a certain level of authenticity, I suppose. I doubt that you have to have everything
perfect. Hollywood doesn't even get it perfect half the time.
Yeah, right. I suppose a lot of it's replicas of either the weapons or the uniforms or whatever. But I looked into it. I'm like, this would be something that I feel like I would really enjoy. I would enjoy piecing the uniform together.
Yeah.
And then actually going to and doing fake battles and whatever. But the more I looked into it, the more expensive it seemed traveling.
More expensive it got.
Yeah, right. And it was kind of cool. They actually do like a boot camp. Like, okay, it's your first time doing this. You're so here's how we do it. Here's how you do the reenactment. Here's how you got to act and like little tricks to make it look a little more realistic or whatever. And then you learn some maneuvers and, you know, and I was never in the military. Ever since I was a little kid, I've just thought Army guys are cool. And me and my friends would put on a Army camo shirt and go in the woods and pretend to fight bad guys, you know, whatever. And so I've always been like into military stuff, not like an expert level, but just fun. I was never in the military. I've always respected the military. I've always felt like unworthy to be around guys who've actually risked their lives for my freedom, you know. But yeah, I just feel like that would be one way to kind of take part, is to be a military reenactment. But
I have the same issue with vintage hi-fi gear. It's the same deal. It's like, well, sure, that'd be neat to have one of those. Where would I put it?
Yeah.
Could I even fire it up? Is it safe from tiny hands? Because tiny hands are more important. But if Grandpa's going to have stuff, he's going to have stuff. Where can I put it? So I have the same dilemma with that.
Right.
Which is a subject that I like to touch on often, just guys and their struggles. And one of them is, we were talking about a couple episodes ago, armchair quarterbacking, midlife crisis, that whole angle. And that's part of it is, oh, now I have the money, now I have the time. And this has always been interesting to me. And what can I do with it? And as believers, it's like, well, your life isn't your own.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do with your time really first should come before God with, what would you have me do with myself?
Right.
With my time.
And time and money, yeah.
And so then you start seeing some of the things like, yeah, I really can't see throwing money at that. I can't see throwing that kind of time at that.
Right, yeah. So I'll be happy with the movies and my board games.
Yeah.